Okay, everyone, we can just sit down again, please, and get ready. We got to the end of section B in chapter 8 about remembering Krishna, and there's just one little point about verse 8 which I didn't mention, which I'd like to mention, is that in the Sanskrit, Krishna says the very first line, Abhyasa Yoga Yuktena. Abhyas, as Prabhupada mentions in the word for word, Abhyas, means to practice in the sense of cultivation, in the sense of learning and developing, practicing like that. So the idea there is that we should practice and cultivate and develop our Krishna consciousness. And by doing that, even though in terms of this idea of what we're going to remember at the time of death, even though by our upbringing and the experiences we've had in our lives, we may not be so much trained up in remembering Krishna, or at least, you know, up until the time we take to Krishna consciousness, certainly we've just been in material consciousness, but Abhyasa Yoga Yuktena, if we practice, if we cultivate this remembrance of Krishna and serving Krishna and meditating, thinking about serving Krishna, how to serve him, and this cultivation of Krishna consciousness and action in Krishna consciousness, then by this practice, well, you know what they say, practice makes perfect. So gradually one becomes accustomed to it. And even though by material upbringing, we may have another nature, just some material nature, attracted to all sorts of materialistic things. But if we practice, then our nature will change. In one sense, this is the essence of what we're trying to do in Krishna consciousness. We are trying to change, isn't it? We don't want to remain the same old materialistic person who's just, you know, automatically attracted towards different wrong things. We want to change so we can become attracted to Krishna in a natural way and absorbed in Krishna, focused on Krishna. So Abhyasa Yoga Yuktena, if we practice, if we cultivate Krishna consciousness in this way, then we will change. We will change. We may become unrecognizable in terms of our consciousness, at least, compared to what we were before, which in many cases would be good. Alright, so now here we are in chapter 8, and we're going into section 2. Going back to Godhead by remembering Krishna. So you know, again, this idea, remembering Krishna, cultivating this remembrance, and different examples given to help us remember Krishna in this way, remember him in that way. Krishna will find throughout Bhagavad Gita, and often in these middle six chapters, Krishna addresses a subject, goes on to another subject, and then later, a little later, maybe in the next chapter, goes back to that first subject, and then goes to another subject, and then the following chapter comes back to that subject. So here, Krishna is doing that. If you look at verse 9, he's doing exactly that. One should meditate on the Supreme Person as the one who knows everything, as he who is the oldest, and so on and so forth. These different examples are given. So again, this is the idea of helping us to focus our minds on Krishna. These are now some new ways, some new concepts, you could say, which we can, you know, think about Krishna in terms of. So, oh, interesting point, this is just an interesting little historical point. Would you believe, this is the first verse I ever gave class on. No joking. I remember vividly, we were on Travelling Sankirtan, Travelling Book Distribution in England. It was February or March 1973, and there was a group of four of us travelling in a van, a transit van, which is sort of like a IAS type of thing. And every day one of us would give class, and one day I was the new boy. I only joined in January. And one day they said, well, why don't you give class? And I didn't really think, you know, I should have thought it would have been either more humble or just more realistic. I should have thought, what, me? Give class? How can I give class? But I didn't. I just said, oh, okay. So I started at least giving a class. And after about 10 minutes or 15 minutes, I ran out of things to say. Which is not surprising, because I hadn't really taken too much in. Anyway, that's just, whenever I just turn the page and come across this verse, then I remember that. So we're coming into this section here. It's from verse 9, this verse, to 13. And, you know, actually it's very intimately connected with the next section, which is about pure devotional service. So the point is remembering Krishna. And Krishna, in fact, is going to describe two processes which can be adopted for remembering Krishna. One is in terms of yoga. By yoga I mean like Hatha yoga, Ashtanga yoga, these other types of yogas. I'm sure you remember from yesterday we were talking about the first six chapters, how Krishna discusses different types of yogas. But then right at the end of the sixth chapter we read that verse, Krishna said that Bhakti yoga is the best. So now this middle six chapters is discussing Bhakti yoga. So here then, from verse 10 to 13, Krishna is going to talk about remembering him, but in terms of the practice of one of those other types of yogas. You know, more like a physical discipline, that type of yoga, if you know what I mean. And in fact, the particular type of yoga he refers to in the purport, Prabhupada refers to in the purport of text 10, Shat Chakra Yoga. Perhaps you, I don't know if you've heard of Shat Chakra Yoga, the yoga of the six chakras. So, you know, it's some type of yoga of physical discipline, mental discipline, something like Hatha Yoga, that sort of thing, or, you know, meditation when you just sit down, you know, cross-legged and you try and meditate, or that sort of thing. So it's some process like that. And in midst, or while doing that, boy, what happened to this thing? So while doing all those disciplines, you are then meant to remember Krishna. And by doing that, when the time of death comes, you are meant to be able to go to Krishna by having practiced this yoga and remembered Krishna while doing it. And so we can have a look at these verses, 10 to 13, and I think we'll get the idea that this is not really a very practical process, which is actually Krishna's point in this whole chapter, that the other processes are not really practical, that Bhakti Yoga is very practical and completely practical and real. Okay, so 10 to 13. One who at the time of death fixes his life there between the eyebrows. So, okay, any volunteers? And so on and so forth, and remembers the Supreme Lord, will certainly attain to the Supreme Lord at the time of death. Then 11, people who are learned in the Vedas, who chant Om, who are renounced, who are celibate, you know, these people, they can practice this yoga. So what do you do? This is now verse 12. This is what you do. The yogic situation is that of detachment from all sensual engagements, closing all the doors of the senses and fixing the mind on the heart, and the light there at the top of the head. One establishes himself in this particular type of yoga. So how does that sound? Sounds like fun. We should get someone to demonstrate fixing your light ear at the top of your head. I would like to see that. This is not the one. There's another one mentioned elsewhere where Krishna says you have to merge the incoming breath into the outgoing breath, and in that way suspend your breathing for a few days or years. Would you like to practice that? You can do it for a day and then... Okay, anyway, the thing is, as Krishna says in verse 13, and I think this may be a little loud, it's sort of distorting. Can you hear me at the back anyway? Yeah? Okay, so 13 then, which is the last verse here. After being situated in this yoga practice and vibrating Om, if you think of Krishna and leave your body, you'll reach the spiritual planets. So this is a yogic process. You know, it's a combination of some physical disciplines, lifting the light bears and all that, and focusing the mind on Krishna. But the point, Krishna's point in bringing this up, is that it's not really very practical. It's not really the sort of thing that an ordinary person could do very easily, because don't forget, this is full time. This is not part time. You can't do this for 20 minutes in the morning and half an hour in the evening, and during the day go to work and, you know, hustle around here and there and all that sort of thing. This is a way of life. You have to go to the Himalayas. Goodbye, you know, everything. And no more pick and pay. No more Bollywood movies. No more friends. It's just you. And that's it. For the rest of your life. Yeah. So it's not seriously a real possibility for people like us. On top of which, even if you happen to be the type of person who could do that, even if you were, still it's more effective to render devotional service. You achieve the result faster, and you achieve a higher level of result. So Krishna, again, he's revisiting the subject of, you know, what shall we do? Shall we do some yoga, like this type of yoga? Shall we do devotional service? He's revisiting it to again establish devotional service. Then the next section is 14 to 16, by the looks of things. Yeah. So now he is going to bring in devotional service to address the same point, to show us how devotional service is better. So he says in 14, The one who always remembers me without deviation, I'm easy to obtain, O son of Prita, because of his constant engagement in devotional service. So the other process was not easy, was it? I'm sure it's not easy at all. But here Krishna specifically states this devotional service is very easy through constant engagement of devotional servants. And then to make it clearer, Krishna speaks 15 and 16 that if you do like this, Hare Krishna, boy, what's happening with our microphone here? I'll just carry on. Can you hear me now? You can hear me? Right. So, now we're on to 15. After attaining me, the great souls who are yogis in devotion never return to this temporary world which is full of miseries because they have attained the highest perfection. And 16, from the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery wherein repeated birth and death take place. The one who attains to my abode, O son of Kunti, never takes birth again. So in both verses, what does Krishna say? That the devotee who goes back to Godhead never comes back here again. You know, sometimes the question arises about, you know, if you go back to Godhead, can you fall down again or not? You know, I don't know how many times this question's been raised, but many, many times. But Krishna says here, they never come back. He doesn't come back again. And so the devotees or people who ask about this, they're a little doubtful. That if I go back to Godhead, I may come back again. So if that may happen, you know what their bottom line is? Why don't I just stay here anyway? Why bother, you know, making the effort and getting up early in the morning and chanting my rounds and following the regulative principles if I'm going to come back again? But it's not really, this is like a false dilemma, really. Yeah, it's not really a question, it's the wrong question. So the thing is, well, of course, one point is that if you really decide that you have to come back, you just really, really want to come back, then it's not that you will not be able to. You know, once you've gone back to Godhead, that you'll just lose somehow the capacity to fall down, even if you really just became overwhelmed with the desire to do it. Now, if you really insist, you can come back. But Prabhupada makes a very interesting point. It's in a lecture on one of these two verses, I forget which one, but they're both saying that when you go there you never come back here. So in the verse, in the purport, or in the lecture rather, Prabhupada puts it in a very simple but very nice way. Srila Prabhupada says, no one has done so. How's that? That's good, isn't it? No one has done so. Of course, you might want to be the first one. But, you know, when that no one has come back, so they never come back. No one has done so. And the reason for that is twofold, really. One is because it's so nice up there, you wouldn't really want to leave it. But the other part, which is very important, and which makes one's situation when one goes back, having been here, different from when you were there having not been here before, this factor which makes a big difference is that you can remember what it was like down here. And that is a type of impetus not to come back. You know, I remember Lanasia. Wow. Puripuria. Manea. So, and one thinks, oh my God, I'm not going to go back there. So this is an added factor, even over and above the fact that it is just really wonderful anyway. Right. So, and this is achieved through devotional service, easily. Whereas the other process, this shat chakra yoga or related processes of physical discipline and going off to the Himalayas or the Drakensberg perhaps and just sitting there and, you know, that's it for the rest of your life. They're really not easy processes at all. But devotional service is very easy. So then, Krishna goes on in section E, comparing the material and spiritual worlds. Well, the basic idea, this is from 17 to 22, I think. The basic idea here is to bring out the fact that we should really do this. It is really worth doing this. You know, what you're going to achieve through doing this is just the most wonderful and glorious thing compared to the alternative, which is Johannesburg 2005, which is not so glorious. So, then Krishna in 17, 18 and 19, I won't read the verses, but Krishna describes the basic process of material existence, birth and death, creation, destruction, and, well, there's verse 19, you see the Sanskrit, bhutagrama sa evayam, bhutva bhutva paliyate. Bhutva bhutva means repeatedly taking birth and praliyate, being annihilated. So Prabhupada, in commenting, lecturing on this verse once, he said, yes, bhutva bhutva, you get booted again and again, repeatedly. The royal order of the boot. So this is the idea here, that it's a good idea to get out of that. Don't stick around if you don't have to. And then 20, we're going on to, what is it, 22, yeah? 20, 21 and 22, well, 20 and 21 first. 20 and 21, Krishna now contrasts that material nature that he just described with the glorious spiritual nature. There's another unmanifest nature. Unmanifest means it's beyond our perception. It's not manifest to us. It is manifest, it exists, but to us it's unmanifest. So it's eternal and is transcendental to this manifested and unmanifested matter. It's supreme and is never annihilated. When all in this world is annihilated, that part remains as it is. And in 21, that place, unmanifest, infallible, supreme destination again, that place from which, having attained it, one never returns, that is my supreme abode. Yes. So we should go there. This is like an advertisement. You should go there. Come to Goloka Vrindavan. Eternal life full of bliss and full of knowledge. Yeah. Right. And then 22. Well, again, this is Krishna driving the point home about bhakti, devotional service. It's the only way, as the Christians say. It's the only way. Well, it's true. He's enlivening us. Purusha sapara parta bhakta labhyas bhaktya labhyas tvananyaya yasyantastari bhutani yena sarvam idam tatam. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is greater than all, is attainable by unalloyed devotion. Although he's present in his abode, he's all pervading and everything is situated within him. Now, in the Sanskrit, in the second line, there is a very important term, or two important terms, which can be connected together as one, which is the real essence now of the subject. So the first part is bhakti, the second part is ananya. Ananya means other. Ananya means no other. So unalloyed bhakti, ananya bhakti. This is the idea. We have to cultivate unalloyed devotional service. Not some mixed devotional service, like, well, just an interesting little example, like that, the yoga that was described a few verses ago, right? Of lifting the life here to the head and all that. So, our previous acharyas talk about how a devotee may think that if I incorporate some of this yoga practice, some physical exercise or life ears or whatever it is, if I incorporate that in my bhakti, it may help me in my bhakti. And therefore the devotee may think that before I start chanting my rounds, I will do pranayama. You know what pranayama is? Breathing exercises. You know, some sort of breathing exercise. I'll do breathing exercises for half an hour. Then I'll be able to chant my rounds really nicely. So Baladev Vijayabhushan says, this is yoga mishra bhakti. Mishra means mixed with. So it is bhakti, but mixed with this yoga. And it doesn't really help. It's just a bit of a distraction to think we need to do it. Just like Prabhupada, one time a devotee went to Prabhupada and said, you know, I think our devotees should do some hatha yoga. Prabhupada just sort of, you know, just went like, And the devotee said, yeah, for exercise. They need exercise. Prabhupada said, yes, exercise, yes. Jumping jacks. You know what jumping jacks are? You know, jumping up and down, all that. And the devotee said, well, actually I was thinking more of hatha yoga. And Prabhupada said, yes, yes, jumping jacks. So it may help, you know, particularly as you're getting older, and if you're sitting in a chair most of the time, you need to get some exercise. That's a fact. That's why I'm walking up and down and jumping. But, you know, to consider it from the spiritual point of view, an essential part, or an essential thing which will help our bhakti, is not really right. And in the purport there, Baladev Vijayabhushan, in the purport of this verse now, where ananya bhakti is referred to, unalloyed devotional service, Baladev Vijayabhushan puts things a very nice way. He says that ananya bhakti, or pure, unalloyed devotional service, is so powerful that it can sweep away any obstacles which get in its way, like material attachments, material desires, and whatever, fears. He says, just like the Ganges, as the Ganges comes down from the Himalayas, whatever is in front of it is swept away. So similarly, ananya bhakti, unalloyed devotional service, is so powerful that anything that gets in the way is just swept away. Just swept away. So therefore we should cultivate pure devotional servants. Unalloyed devotional servants. Okay, now we're on to the last section from 23 to 28. And again, in this section, Krishna is again going to make a comparison between the yogi people and the devotees. And now very specifically in regards to how they deal with death. Because this is like the underlying theme throughout here. How are we going to be fixed in Krishna consciousness at the time of death? So in 23, in 23 Krishna just says that I'm going to explain these things, but 24 and 25 and 26, Krishna talks about the process of death for the yogis, and maybe also some karmis, but more particularly the yogis, or at least very particularly those who are not devotees. There are some stringent requirements if you are to be successful, so to speak, in meeting the time of death and remaining fixed at the time of death. If you're involved in these practices, there are some very stringent requirements. And Krishna describes these here in 24 and 25. That those who know the Supreme Brahman attain the Supreme by passing away, by dying. So the point is here about the time of death. By passing away from the world, during the influence of the fiery god, in the light, at an auspicious moment of the day, during the fortnight of the waxing moon, or during the 6 months when the sun travels in the north. Then 25. The mystic who passes away from this world during the smoke, the night, the fortnight of the waning moon, or the 6 months when the sun reaches to the south, reaches the moon planet, but again comes back. In other words, you cannot just die any time when you're doing these processes. If death is coming, the Yamadutas are knocking on the door, you just got to tell them, hang on a second, look. It is the southern summer, right? Because if you die when the sun passes to the south, then you may go to the moon, but you come back again. So you're not allowed to die in the southern summer, okay? Only the northern summer, which is our winter. Got it? So you just hang in there. Or, you're not allowed to die at night either. Even if it was the northern summer, but it was night, you're still not allowed to die, or you shouldn't die, because you'll come back again. So, and so on and so forth. There's all these considerations as we read. So, this is a whole thing. This is really a whole thing. And in 26, Krishna summarizes these two verses. There are two ways of passing, in light or darkness. And the first verse, 24, is what he's referring to as in light, and verse 25 is in darkness. If you pass in light, you don't come back, you just go back to Godhead. But if you pass during the darkness, you take birth again. Yeah. Along with having to lift your life ear to the top of your head and all that stuff, So then 27 and 28 are very nice verses. Although the devotees know these two paths, in other words, the devotees are knowledgeable. They understand what's going on and different opportunities. They understand. But still, they are never bewildered. Jack of all trades, master of none. You know? On Monday, I worship Lord Shiva. On Tuesday, Durga. On Wednesday, Muhammad. Thursday, Jesus. You know, trying to be well covered. Have all your bases covered. But it won't work. So the devotees, though, they're never bewildered. Therefore, be always fixed in devotion. And 28, really wonderful verse. A person who accepts the path of devotional service is never bereft of the results derived from studying the Vedas, performing austere sacrifices, giving charity, or pursuing philosophical and fruitive activities. Simply by performing devotional service, he attains all these, and at the end he reaches the supreme eternal abode. So, you know, whatever you could have achieved by any of the other processes, if you simply do devotional service, you can achieve those things, but at the end you'll go back to Godhead, which is not really available in the other processes. So if you want money, you render devotional service, you can get money and then go back to Godhead. If you want whatever, if you want good health, you can get it. If you want a husband or wife, you can have these things and at the end go back to Godhead. This is the point. That Krishna consciousness, devotional service, is all encompassing. It is the complete process. So there's no need to do anything other than devotional service. Okay. So now we can go on to chapter 9. Yes, okay. Ananya Bhakti, No. His question is that, you know, we said you should do Ananya Bhakti Analoid devotional service, and you know, we said something about yoga mishra bhakti, how these some hatha yoga practice, for example, if we think that it'll help our bhakti, that's not really correct. So your question was, does that mean we shouldn't do these things at all?
Yeah, like I know some person who do hatha yoga because it helps pay a number, it's a nice strength in the chant.
I see. So the question is then, well, he says, Vishabhana Prabhu says, he knows some devotees who do some hatha yoga to help them stay awake better in the class. Yeah, like that. So, and this helps in their bhakti, right? Because they stay awake in the class. So, but the thing is, you know, we said that to get some exercise, the body needs some exercise anyway, just to be kept in an operative condition without breaking down. But, you know, what is it that should help us stay awake in the class? If we actually become attracted to hearing about Krishna, which is part of bhakti. If you're not attracted to hearing about Krishna, but you stay awake because you just did your physical exercises, or you know, you slept 12 hours at night, this could be a case for sleeping more. So we stay awake, we never fall asleep while we chant our rounds, because we sleep 15 hours, and then we're always awake. But if your mind is not attracted to hearing about Krishna, then you may be wide awake in the class, but your mind will be elsewhere. But if your mind, if you're cultivating attachment to Krishna specifically, then you'll stay awake anyway. You'll stay awake anyway. Whether, you know, even if you were falling asleep, I don't know if you were there for the Madhurya Kadamani course. There was talk about Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said that, like a person on the level of Nishta, if even if he's feeling sleepy, but then there's some Krishna Katha, he'll wake up because he has a spontaneous attraction. A devotee on the level of Ruchi, he may be asleep, but if there's some Krishna Katha, he'll just wake up because of the spontaneous attraction, just arouses him within. So that's really the critical thing. But still, particularly if people are not getting enough exercise anyway, they should get some exercise, and Hatha Yoga is very good. There are many devotees, some devotees who, like very senior devotees, who do Hatha Yoga every day, and they feel it's very beneficial for their physical condition. Yeah. Yeah. I hope that's okay. To stay fit, which will help in their devotional service, because, you know, if you're constantly diseased and plagued by all sorts of material, physical problems, you know, like headaches and like Satsvarup Maharaj, well, it becomes a real challenge to your Krishna consciousness, ultimately. Okay. Right, so we're now in chapter 9. Let's just... There's a comment by Srila Prabhupada in the third paragraph of the purport. Yeah. Just find the third paragraph in the purport, okay? The very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, the first chapter, is more or less an introduction to the rest of the book. And in the second and third chapters, the spiritual knowledge described is called confidential. Topics discussed in the seventh and eighth chapters are specifically related to devotional service, and because they bring enlightenment and Krishna consciousness, they're called more confidential. But the matters which are described in the ninth chapter deal with unalloyed, pure devotion. Therefore, this is called the most confidential, which is the name of the chapter after all. So, Ananya Bhakti. This chapter then is focusing on unalloyed pure devotion, or Ananya Bhakti. And it's therefore the most confidential knowledge. So Krishna begins, the first section is verse 1 to verse 3. We say, hearing about Krishna, qualifications and disqualifications. For hearing about Krishna. Hearing about Krishna is very important because it will help you to fix your mind on Krishna and understand Krishna like that. So in the first verse, what is the particular qualification that Krishna mentions? Non-envious. Non-envious. Because you're not envious of me. I now speak this most confidential wisdom. Isn't it something like that? I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you'll be relieved of the miseries of material existence. So, yeah, enviousness of Krishna. Baladeva Vijayabhushan gives a nice definition of envy in his purport to this verse. He says, envy means that you, as you study a person, you search to find faults, even in the midst of many good qualities. So here we have a person, we're looking at the person, saying, what sort of person do we have here? And we say there are many good qualities, they're kind, they're humble, they're tolerant, they're gentle and whatever, so many good qualities are there. But no, 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 no. Then we find that, you know, something. Sometime they get a little uptight with someone or something like that. You know, whatever. They get a little angry sometime. Or maybe they sleep too much. Or maybe that we find them doing hatha yoga and we think, aha! Oh, oh. What sort of devotion is this? So this is envy. That many good qualities are there, but we find one fault and then we think, now we have understood this person. And we don't care about the so many good qualities, but now we make an issue of this. This is enviousness. Yeah, this is enviousness. So we have to be very careful of envy. In fact, we should try and be very broad-hearted and appreciate all the devotees, appreciate their qualities, even if in some cases the qualities are not very great. Still we should appreciate the qualities and overlook the shortcomings unless they're serious, unless they're important. Yeah, it's very important. Envy. One time, Prabhupada was meant to give a program in Paris, like a whole program. So they went, they set up the Vyasasan and everything, and Prabhupada was just about to begin with the lecture when some young communist boys just interrupted and heckling and shouting, and why are you sitting on that big seat and things like that. And the whole program had to be cancelled. I think I may have mentioned this during the Madhurya Kadamani course. So the whole program was cancelled. Finished. Because these people were just making too much of a scene. And so the devotees went back and they were sitting with Prabhupada. They said, wow, that was amazing. That was really amazing. These people were criticizing you. The devotees appreciated Prabhupada so much. They said, they were criticizing you. We can't believe it. And Prabhupada said, that's nothing. When Krishna was here, so many people criticized him. So that is the nature of this material world. People are prone to be envious. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that if any time when you see a devotee, if you do not feel very happy that, oh, look, here's a devotee, how nice, like that. If you don't feel very happy, he says, you're already a resident of hell. Yeah. So, you know, here comes a devotee, and it's, you know, one of those devotees, right? And you think, oh, no. It's him again. So this is a problem, and we should really understand we have a problem if we're thinking like that. So the qualification for hearing about Krishna and being able to remember and fix our minds on Krishna, one very, very vital element is to not be envious of Krishna. Doesn't mean it's okay to be envious of the devotees but not of Krishna. We should not be envious. Right, and so now, this knowledge then, most confidential knowledge, Krishna, in verse 2, explains like some of the wonderful characteristics, you could say. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It's the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self, by realization it's the perfection of religion. It's everlasting and is joyfully performed. Well, our acharyas make some comments on each of those points. It's so secret because it explains the soul's relationship with Krishna. It's so purifying that it cleanses one of all the effects of sin without the aid of any other process. It is the perfection of religion because you can directly perceive the object within the process, unlike other processes where the process does not embody the result. I don't know if you got that. Might sound a little complicated, but you know, like that other yoga system which was mentioned in the 8th chapter, right? You're meant to lift your life air up to the top of your head and whatever it was. These different types of practices. And then if you remember Krishna, then you can go to some higher realm. So when you go to the higher realm, you should know you don't sit around lifting your life air to the top of your head. You do something else. You do something else. But in devotional service, the process is devotional service. And when you go to where you're going, back to Godhead, you do devotional service. So the process embodies the result. You get the idea? But in the other processes, they don't embody the result. The result is different from the process. I hope that's clear enough. So, you know, we're sitting here hearing about Krishna, and in the spiritual world, they sit around hearing about Krishna. We take prasadam, they take prasadam. We have a kirtan, they have a kirtan. The process embodies the result. It's just a question of degree of advancement which makes the difference between, you know, whether you're just in the process or whether you're at the result. And Prabhupada gave the example of a mango, green mango and ripe mango. If you have a little green mango that's just starting to come, then if you try and eat it, I think it's not very nice, isn't it? It's certainly not like if you let the very same mango become a big, rich mango and you eat that. So if you eat the little green mango, you may think, what is this? You know, the mangoes are useless. But actually the same mango later will be very luscious and wonderful. So a neophyte devotee may be making many mistakes and, you know, really a beginner. And you may think, oh, what sort of devotee is this? But the same devotee doing the same things will become a pure devotee in due course. So in this way it's the perfection of religion, because the means and the end are not two, they're one, just different degrees of one thing. Then it's everlasting because it goes on after liberation. Same point from a different perspective. The other processes end when you achieve the goal. This process never ends. It's everlasting. It's joyful. Well, for many reasons, but one reason is because you can engage your senses without inhibition. You can just go for it and run and jump and, you know, be happy. Yeah. So, you know, you can very freely practice. And it's very easy. As Krishna says, we'll see in a few verses, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam. You just offer one leaf, one fruit, one flower with devotion. Krishna says, I'll accept it. So easy. Okay, now we go on to, you'll love this, it's a very, oh no, wait a minute, sorry. Verse 3, the last verse here. Krishna, well, the title we gave this section was Qualifications and Disqualifications. So if you're not faithful, then those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, they return to the path of birth and death in this material world. If you're not faithful, if you're envious, if you don't accept these things and really, you know, apply them strongly and give it your best effort, then if you're not careful, you'll just sort of fall away and end up back in material life, doing all the same old things and suffering in material existence. Now we go on to section B. Krishna's Achintya Bheda Bheda relationship with the material world from verse 4 to verse 10, which is a little complex. We'll just touch on it briefly. Krishna starts with two interesting verses, 4 and 5. By me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I'm not in them. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I'm the maintainer of all living entities, and although I'm everywhere, I'm not part of this cosmic manifestation. For myself is the very source of creation. So, you know, Krishna says, all beings are in me. Then he says, that was verse 4 and verse 5, and yet everything that is created does not rest in me. According to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Arjuna says, after the second of these two verses, you have just contradicted yourself. You should be careful what you say to Krishna. Or any bigger person, you know, you don't just sort of let them have it. So Arjuna's taking a chance here. You just contradicted yourself. Krishna, according to Vishnu Chakravarti Tara, Krishna replies, no, it is actually my expertise. Yes, that is very intriguing. Achintya bade abade. Tattva, how this works. Everything is in Krishna, everything is not in Krishna. Got it. You got that, you passed. Yeah, it's like that. Everything is in Krishna, everything is not in Krishna. So what does this mean? Well, let's see. Yeah, verse 6 gives a nice way of understanding. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. So, yeah, that's one way of looking at it. You know, when they're in the sky, they're not... The sky is just space. You cannot touch space, can you? Because it's just space. You can touch the air within the space, but you can't touch the space. So it's like that. Well, also, the way it is again this idea of the energy and the energetic, there being oneness between the energy and the energetic, but at the same time not oneness. So, this world, we are all created beings are within this world, which is made of Krishna's energy, and Krishna's energy in one sense is him, and therefore he said, I'm the taste of water, and so on. But at the same time, Krishna is in Goloka Vrindavan. Krishna is not here exactly. Yeah. So in that sense, everything is within him, but everything is not within him at the same time. This is his achintya bade abade relationship. And I know it may sound a little intangible, but this is why the philosophy is called achintya bade abade. Achintya means inconceivable. You know, you can get the idea, but to put your finger on it exactly may be a little difficult. It may be a little difficult. Therefore, the word achintya, which means inconceivable, is used. Everything's within Krishna, because everything is within Krishna's energy. Just like we are all within the light, but the light is up there. But still, in another sense, we're within the light, which is the energy of the light ball. So there's a type of oneness there, but there's also a type of separation. We are all South Africans, so we are part of South Africa, but we are all individuals at the same time. We are not just mechanically functioning, you know, as part of South Africa. We have our individuality. But at the same time, we cannot escape from the South African scene. So this is a chintya bhed abhed tattva. Everything is within Krishna, but at the same time, Krishna is outside of everything. So Krishna goes on in, let's see, verse 8. He's explaining now his relationship within this, with this world, in terms of the functions of this world, like creation, destruction, and the running of this world, in verses like 7, 8, 9, and 10. In 8 he says, this whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will it is automatically manifested again and again. And under my will it's annihilated. So his point here is, he's not actually doing anything, he's just willing it. And just by his will it happened. That Prabhupada said, Krishna's will is fact. As soon as Krishna desires something, it becomes fact. Even if it's something unusual, which you wouldn't expect. But if Krishna desires it, there it is. When we desire something unusual, it may be very difficult to manifest it. You know, I would like a new Rolls Royce. We desire, the will is there, but the manifestation is not so easy. But if Krishna wills, I think I'd like a new universe. There it is. Yeah. But it's just his will. He doesn't get in there and put it all together and, you know, all that sort of thing. So therefore he goes on to say that, oops, where are we? In verse 9, all this work cannot bind me. I'm ever detached from these material activities, seated as though neutral. The term is Udasin Vat. Udasin Vat. Vat means as if, neutral. He's willing, so you cannot say he's totally neutral and totally uninvolved. But it's only his willing. So therefore he is seated as though neutral, very, very detached from the whole situation, but not absolutely removed. If he was absolutely removed, it wouldn't be so good, because it would be difficult to connect with Krishna. Okay, so like this. The material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. Oh, interesting point. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura, to illustrate this point of being like neutral, but still because of him everything is going on. And if you took him out, everything would stop going on, even though he's not doing anything actually. He gives the example of Maharaj Ambarish. Maharaj Ambarish is mentioned in the ninth canto as a great king, ninth canto of the Bhagavatam. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes that all he did, like all day, 7 days a week, all he did was chant Hare Krishna, worship the deity, that was it. He was the king. He never went and ruled and told people what to do and all that sort of stuff. He had others doing it. He was just doing puja and chanting. So therefore, some people would say, well, what do we need him for? Let's just get rid of him. Why should we give him any honor or taxes or anything? He's not doing anything. But if you had taken Maharaj Ambarish out, everything would have stopped. Because just by his presence, people were inspired and everything was going on. So it's kind of like that with Krishna in the material world. You know, as Prabhupada would say, Krishna does not have to report to the office in the morning. He doesn't have to check in at the factory. He doesn't. He just plays the flute and dances, that's all, and enjoys himself. But still, because of him, everything is going on. But just because of his will, not because he gets in there and works on things. Right, now, let's see. Section C, this is very important. Part of it, at least, is very, very important. Non-worshippers and worshippers. So, you know, verses 11 and 12 are talking about people who do not accept this Achintya Bheda Bhed Tattva understanding. But they think that we're just here to live independently. And if there's a God, his business is to fulfill my desires, and my business is to present my desires. And I do my job very well, and you know, whether he does his job well enough, well, that we'll see. So that type of person is the type of person being described in 11 and 12. People who do not accept Krishna in these ways. So you know this verse, don't you? 11, it's a real classic. Fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the Supreme Lord of all that be. You know, our acharyas say that this includes people who recognize other forms of the Lord, but not Krishna. Because this is Krishna speaking, two-handed Krishna, apparently human, or very human-like Krishna. Others, when Krishna comes in some very mighty, powerful form, they may accept him. But those who don't accept Krishna when he appears in this manusya, rupa, human-like form, then they deride Krishna. And what happens to these people who deride Krishna? Well, verse 12. Those who are thus bewildered are attracted by demonic and atheistic views. In that deluded condition, their hopes for liberation, their fruit of activities, and their culture of knowledge are all defeated. So they become attracted. They become attracted. Just like, isn't it true? I think it's, you know, broadly true that people who are attracted to eating meat, in many, many, many cases, they're also attracted to taking intoxication. Not all, there are definitely exceptions. But if we look in this society of, Western society of ours, meat eating, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling, and so on, it's like a package deal. How many people do you know who only eat meat but they don't take any intoxication, no illicit sex, no gambling or speculation? How many people are like that? There's not many. So when people become they start to deride the Supreme Personality of Godhead, reject the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A certain type of process happens within their heart, in that they just find they're becoming attracted to these things. They just find they're heading in those directions. A natural type of attraction just arises. To what? He says, Rakshasa and Asura. Rakshasim and Asurim. Two particular types of very gross material consciousness, which Prabhupada translates as demonic and atheistic. And, you know, therefore, many, many, at least, of these people who do all these things, they're attracted to something like abortion. Right? They think it's very good. Not a question of is it bad or not, it's very good. Oh, we should do more of it. Yeah. We should encourage it. They're attracted. They're actually attracted to it. Because fundamentally, because of their anti-God type of mentality. But then on the other hand, the point there is about being attracted, that the material energy is getting hold of them, just like a vacuum cleaner. You know, just imagine a vacuum cleaner, but imagine a big vacuum cleaner. And there's us. You know, you wouldn't be able to hold on, would you? You just get drawn in. So the material energy is like that, like a big vacuum cleaner. And people just get sucked in. Even sometimes they say, hey, I shouldn't be doing this. But they just get sucked in. But now the devotees are different. The devotees are different, and this is there in 13 and 14. That those who are not deluded, great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are protected by the spiritual nature. So even though they may be surrounded by all these material things going on, they're not attracted. They're protected by the spiritual nature because of their full engagement in devotional service. Then Krishna describes their characteristic activities. Satatam kirti yanto mam. That's a very interesting point, that Bhagavad Gita is eternal. It's not just for Kali Yuga. Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to the sun god. That was not in a Kali Yuga, that was just somewhere else in some other time. Now, in Kali Yuga, what is the process? The process is chanting. We're told we must chant in order to advance. It's essential. But actually, eternally, this process of chanting has been really in the forefront in the lives of the devotees. So here, when the characteristic activities of the advanced devotees, the mahatmas who are under the protection of the divine nature, the characteristic activities are mentioned. The first is satatam kirta yantama. They're always chanting my glory. So chanting is always the most important thing. Now, how are you doing out there in audience land? Are you doing okay? I see symptoms of what will we call it? Not battle fatigue, but some sort of fatigue going on out there. You don't want to bombard you with too much so that you get shell shock. Oh, wow. You know what he wants us to do? Extend it for another 10 minutes. I knew that would get a laugh. because the prasadam is late. Well, okay, hang on a second, team. Let's not lose it all together, okay? Okay, a question, please. Sorry? Yes, we forget everything. Generally. Would make us what? I'm having difficulty myself. When we die, well, we forget basically what happened in the previous lifetime, because the experience of death is so traumatic. It's like when a person gets amnesia or something like that, you know, or they go through some terrible experience and they get amnesia. So death has that type of effect. But it doesn't mean that they've become detached. That's the wrong point, yeah? Yeah. See, our fundamental propensities of attachment remain in the heart. Even though our conscious mind forgets, you know, who we were and what we were doing in that detailed sense, but our fundamental material propensities, as they have developed in our life to that point, they're carried on over into the next life. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can. If you go back to Godhead, you'll get rid of, you know, if there's some problem cases you'd like to put behind you, you'll become free of them in the sense that you'll no longer be affected by them. You may still remember them, but there's not going to be any sort of emotional response, or, you know, you'll be able to deal with it. Like, even Prabhupada made the point that we've been in so many lifetimes, and each lifetime we died, and death is practically never nice. Usually it's a dramatic and difficult, painful experience. But, and we've been through so many. So Prabhupada, one devotee asked Prabhupada, well, you know, how is it we can't remember all those lifetimes? Prabhupada said it's Krishna's mercy. Because if you remembered all those traumatic experiences, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions, it would just be too much and you'd just lose it altogether. So it's Krishna's mercy. You just come out, you know, the next lifetime thinking, wow. But the fundamental propensity remains. Like, from the previous lifetime, a person had, say, male propensities. They come out in the next lifetime with inbuilt male propensities, or vice versa, like that. Yeah. So, even though they cannot remember where it came from, but, you know, those fundamental kind of like attitudes that people have, they're built into the person. This is why some children are nicer, or say more peaceful than others. Some children are, you know, just sort of wild, and some children are very peaceful and passive. And, you know, children, they have, and, you know, they haven't had time yet in this lifetime to become conditioned and develop, you know, that much of a personality yet. But still, there, you know, there's some type of personality there. So it means those basic personality traits have been carried over from the previous lifetime, like that. Yeah. Yes. And when you go back to Godhead, you can remember all the lifetimes you've had. Not that you'll be sitting there just thinking about these things. You'll be thinking of Krishna. But sometimes if the idea comes up, well, what about the material world? Or, you know, someone comes back from the material world and you see, oh, this is someone came back from the material world, then some remembrance may come, which is not, because in that pure condition your consciousness is not under the influence of ignorance at all. Therefore you can remember clearly everything. Now we may struggle to remember so many things. But there's nothing to inhibit the remembrance other than your desire. So if you desire to remember those things, you know, you get an amazing recollection of what material life was, which will make you think, wow, I don't want that. I want Krishna. So then you desire to remember Krishna, then you'll remember Krishna and be happy. Am I addressing your point? Okay, anyway.
Yes, sir. Yeah. That being said, if you remember certain personality of the material world, that then means that you can intervene and help their spiritual life by bringing them back.
If you remember them.
Yeah, because you're not saying that in the spiritual world, but you're living in personality.
Okay. His Rishabhana Prabhu's question is, if we go to Goloka Vrindavan and we remember people in the material world, can we intervene
and help them?
And help them?
Yeah.
Well, you know, my understanding would be that if you just desire for them to be helped, then you, as a great exalted Nitya Siddha, pure devotee, your desire will be fulfilled by Krishna, that he will see they get helped. Yeah, even if you don't go down there to do something about it, but Krishna will see that that's put into effect. Definitely. Definitely. Okay, where were we? We were up to verse 15. That, can we have your attention, everyone, please? You know, in the past, not really now, because devotees are more enlightened, that devotees have used different methods for dealing with, you could say, in classes with problematic devotees who either fall asleep or start, you know, little side conversations and stuff. And one extremely effective thing they use is called the water pistol. Maybe we should. So we'll put in a request for one. So in verse 15, Krishna now brings up some other people, three other classes of people. He just mentions them. Those who are engaged in the culture of knowledge, they are the, well, where are we now? No, wait. That's all of them. So some of them, they worship the Supreme Lord as one without a second. That's the impersonalists. Some worship him as diverse and many, that's the demigod worshippers, and others worship him in the universal form. Then in the next section, 16 to 25, the first part from, I think it's 16, 17, 18, and 19, Krishna now talks about the activities of these people who worship the universal form. If you look there, you'll see. Again, Krishna says, I am the ritual, I am the sacrifice, I am the offering to the ancestors. Specifically, this is a description of the activities of people who worship the universal form, although in another sense, in terms of what we said yesterday about chapter 7, I am the taste in water and all that sort of thing. It can also be applied in that sense as, you know, further assistance how we can see Krishna everywhere, his energies and how he's empowering different things. You get the idea. So these are further examples. He is the butter, the fire, the offering, the father of the universe, the mother, the support, the grandeur. People who worship the universal form, they will see like this. But it can also help the neophyte devotees to appreciate Krishna's presence. So that's those verses. Then, in 20 and 21, and 22, like we said, Krishna goes back and forth a bit. It's, you know, he's very systematic. But until you learn the system, sometimes it may appear to be a little not so systematic, but it is systematic. He is now going to compare again the demigod worshippers with the devotees. The demigod worshippers with the devotees to again bring out the superiority of devotional service. Again. So 20 and 21. These people, demigod worshippers, they study the Vedas, drink the soma juice, and so on and so forth. Then they go to the planet of Indra. And then 21, when they've thus enjoyed vast heavenly sense pleasure, and the results of their pious activities are exhausted, they come back here again. Back to Johannesburg. Back home, back to Johannesburg. Thus those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas achieve only repeated birth and death. Then 22, now in 22 Krishna is going to contrast the devotees to those who worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form. To them I carry what they lack and preserve what they have. Krishna personally intervenes in the life of the devotees and elevates the devotees. There's a lot I could say about that, but you know, the point is that Krishna personally intervenes. He uses the word vahami, that I carry things to my devotees. You know, like here. Oh, it's empty. Here. Right? Personally carry it. So Krishna does it personally. He doesn't send someone else to do it on his behalf because he's God, and you know, being God, he's very busy, so he hasn't got time to carry a packet of peanuts to Vrishabhanu. He gets, you know, Shorin to do it, or something like that. But no, the point is, Krishna personally carries to his devotees. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his purport, he raises the point that the devotees then, they're so busy serving Krishna, they haven't got time to look after themselves. So Krishna looks after them. And he says, wouldn't it be better, this is like Arjuna speaking, wouldn't it be better if the devotees did less devotional service and looked after themselves? Because now they're engaging Krishna in their service, which is opposed to devotional service. We are meant to be serving Krishna, and now Krishna is serving us. So isn't this a sign of a lack of real love for Krishna, that they're doing so much service that he is forced to look after them? And Krishna replies that no, I enjoy it, I like it. Actually, let me just read what he says. I happen to have a copy of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's Bhagavad Gita commentary here. And he says, Arjuna says, well, Krishna speaking, one should also not say that in giving the burden of their maintenance to their worshipable Lord, the devotees show a lack of prema. In fact, they do not give to me that burden. I, by my own will, accept it. It should also be understood that I am not bearing it as a duty, as I create and maintain the universe by my will alone. Rather, being attached to my devotees, I take the greatest pleasure in taking care of their needs, like carrying the weight of one's lover. And the little example given there is that a boy and a girl, boyfriend and girlfriend, are walking hand in hand in the country, just like in the Bollywood movie. And the orchestra is playing, the dancing girls are coming out. It's just what happens every day in the forest. Then they come to a river. They come to a river. And what to do? The girl says, "Will you carry me across the river?" And the boy, what does he say? Carry you? Why should I carry you? You carry yourself. You're too heavy. No, he picks her up. He's very happy to have this opportunity, to have this intimate exchange with her. So like this, Krishna's feeling, I enjoy it. He actually feels that he's looking for opportunities to do that, to serve the devotees. Yeah. So this is very nice, the relationship between Krishna and the devotees. So then, let's see. Now, we're at 23, 24, and 25. I don't know if any of you are attached to demigod worship. If you are, better fasten your seatbelt. Because, you know, already Krishna has made reference to demigod worship. What did he say? Alpa medasa. Those people have small intelligence. Their fruits are limited and temporary. But my devotees get eternal results. So that was the beginning. Now Krishna really just makes everything vividly clear. So let's read these verses, couple of verses. 23. Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith actually worship only me, O son of Kunti. But they do so in a wrong way. Those demigods, like, you know, Lakshmi is giving wealth. Now whose wealth is it? It's Krishna. But she is just, you know, like, in a sense, just like in the grant office, if you're getting a pension or something. You know, there's the grant officer, they hand you over the money. But it's not their money. It's coming from the government. So same thing, it's Krishna's money, but Lakshmi is there, she has the duty to dispense the money and evaluate the cases and like that. But actually it's Krishna's money, he is giving it. And she can't, and if he says no, don't give him any more, then whether she likes it or not, that person is not getting anything anymore. So, yeah, he is actually the person involved. So when they worship the demigod, because they want the money, effectively it's really for Krishna. But it's being done in a wrong way, because they think that she deserves it. But it's not her money, it's his. So that really they're worshipping him, but it's being done in the wrong way, being offered to the wrong person. I'm the only enjoyer and master of all sacrifices. Therefore, those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down. If they haven't fallen down already, they're on the way. Yeah. And then to sum it up, verse 25 is very nice. Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me, which means eternal life, full of bliss and full of knowledge. Whereas living with the demigods means temporary life. Eventually they die, and then who knows where they're going to be born. You can't really say, even though they're demigods, but where they'll be born next time, you cannot just assume it's going to be very nice. You know, in the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam, in one purport, Prabhupada makes the point that every living entity, when they first enter this material world, coming from the kingdom of God, they first fall into material existence. The first birth is as a Lord Brahma, the creator of a universe. There are many universes. Actually, there's millions and billions. So the first birth is as a Lord Brahma. So that means, what does that mean? It means you were a Lord Brahma once. What do you think of that? You were all Lord Brahmas. We were all Lord Brahmas. But we ended up here in Johannesburg, which is a bit of a letdown, having been a Lord Brahma. So, you know, you're all very nice, and particularly because you're devotees, but, you know, being there amongst the demigods is no guarantee that you're always going to be in a nice situation. Sooner or later you'll come down. But if you go to Krishna and Krishna Loka, Goloka Vrindavan, Krishna says, you never come back again to this material world. Right, let's see. Can we finish now, or should we carry on? We're waiting for them to appear. So we may be continuing indefinitely. So just perk yourselves up and get ready for it, right? Maybe we should get the fire hose in. All right, so now we come to the last section here. And this is a really wonderful section. The glories of directly worshipping Krishna. This is really, when you talk about ananya bhakti, this is where it is really coming out very strongly. Practically the most strongly. Unalloyed, pure devotional service. The value of it, the power of it, the wonderful results of it, even in the face of obstacles, how it can act so amazingly. Ananya bhakti. So first point is verse 26, well-known verse. If we offer Krishna with love and devotion a leaf, flower, fruit or water, he will accept it. And Prabhupada makes the point that Krishna is using singular, one leaf, one fruit, one flower, offered with devotion, he'll accept it, means you're accepted, you're being purified by his, you're getting his great mercy. So, this is, you know, talk about the simplicity of devotional service. It's so wonderful. So wonderful. Anyone who cannot offer one leaf or one fruit, anyone can do it. A child can do it. Yeah. So devotional service is so wonderful. And Krishna accepts that one leaf or whatever, and you go back to Godhead, and the leaf goes back to Godhead sometimes. You know, devotional service is so wonderful that, you know, we offer our food to Krishna, of course. And that food, the living entities in the potatoes and the rice and the beans. That works. a lot of you up, isn't it? That'd be you. So there's a living entity in those vegetables and grains. Prabhupada discusses this. At least they'll get a human birth next. They may become devotees. Prabhupada says they may go back to Godhead just through being offered in devotion. If they're really cooked very nicely and offered very nicely, the living entity in that potato, in that sugar bean, sweet living bean, may go back to Godhead. And when you go back, you may meet that living being. Of course, he or she may not be in the body of a bean. They may be in human forms, who knows? But they may approach you and say, "You remember me. I was that bean, that last bean that you're thinking, should I eat it or is it too much? That was me." Serious. No joking. Absolutely serious. Okay, so then in terms of simplicity, 27 and 28 are also in that category. Well, you know, in a certain sense it's referring to like spinach, you know, edible types of things like that. But really the point is the devotion. The point is the devotion. One, you know, one can use leeks. I don't know if we have any here, but you can use them in garlands, you can use them in decoration of the altar. You know, there are different ways of using leaves in the service of Lord. Plus some leaves are edible anyway. So there's a place for offering leaves.
The other thing is that air pollution in all the countries has blown up.
Oh.
Because the companies are working. Oh. They have given us another 10 years.
Oh.
Which is much bigger.
Oh.
And more ventilation.
Oh.
So maybe after we can go there. After you see the light show here.
Okay. Okay. So prasadam is slightly delayed. Prasadam is honestly excuse me. Okay, yeah, we were saying 27 and 28, right. 27 is the process, 28 is like the result. 27 is pointing out also the simplicity, how easy the process is. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, whatever austerities you perform, whatever, anything you do, do it as an offering to me, Krishna said. So whatever you do, Arjuna was a warrior, that was what he did. So he did it for Krishna. It wasn't that he had to become something else. Now you become now a businessman or some big, you go onto the altar and worship on the altar very nicely and then I'll accept you. No, you just do. You fight? Okay, you fight. But you do it for me. You cook? Okay, you cook for me. Like this. Very simple. Very simple. You eat. Everyone eats. So you eat? Okay. Just offer the food to me. Like this. Everyone gives some charity. Just give it to Krishna. Simple thing. You don't have to become something that you're not. You know, like go through some sort of mental exercise to somehow change yourself. No, whatever you do, whatever comes naturally, just do it for Krishna. That's 27. And 28 is the result. In this way you'll be freed from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious results. With your mind fixed on me in this principle of renunciation, you'll be liberated and come to me. So you'll go back to Krishna just by doing whatever comes naturally to you. Whatever it is. If you can act, if you can sing, if you can speak, if you can manage, if you can clean, anything. You just do it. But do it for Krishna. Right. So now we come into, it's actually a very intriguing part, and this is really, in a sense, this is where the exceptional, unique nature of devotional service, particularly compared to other processes, really, really comes out. And I hope you're all tuned in. The prasadam will taste better. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Or, no, actually, in Russia, you know what they say? Hunger is the best chef. This is a Russian saying. Hunger is the best chef. Right, so Krishna is going to bring out the unique nature of devotional service in a very vivid way, which, you know, in most cases will exceed the expectations of, you know, a person who is considering how merciful the Lord could be or how effective a process could be. So the first thing, to just start, get this point rolling. In verse 29, Krishna says, I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone, unequal to all, but whoever renders service unto me in devotion as a friend is in me, and I am also a friend to him. So basically the point here is that for people on the material platform, Krishna, he has no favorites, he doesn't dislike anyone. It just depends what their karma is. If your karma is to get this, Krishna sees you get it. It may be something bad. He just sees you get it. It's not in even the slightest way an expression of his some negative feeling towards you. And another person, he gives something very good because of their karma, they deserve it, he sees they get it. It is not in the slightest an expression of some favoritism or anything like that at all. As he says here, samoham, sama means the same. I am the same to everyone on the material level. However, anyone who renders service to me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I'm also a friend to them. So Krishna favors his devotees. Just like in same chapter verse 22 I mentioned, there are many things we could say about it. There are many things we could say about verse 22. What did Krishna say? He said that for my devotees, I preserve what they have, I carry to them what they lack. The implication of that is that in terms of your karma, you may be lacking something, because in terms of your karma, you are not due to have that. So try as you may, you will not get that, because it's your karma. But Krishna, if he sees that you could use that in your devotional service, it could help you, then even though in terms of your karma you are not due to get it and you will not get it, but he will personally give it to you. He will carry it and give it. And then he says that I preserve what they have. In this case you have something now, but in terms of your karma you should now lose it. as happens. Things come and go. So you should lose it. But Krishna sees you don't lose it by his personal arrangement. These are just examples of how Krishna favors his devotees. Their karma says one thing, but he does another thing. He has the right because he is God. And he does it with his devotees. So that is the point here in verse 29. When Krishna says, I am a friend to them, it means like that. He favors them. Because they are going out of their ways to serve him, he goes out of his way to help them.
In 922, Prabhupada says, one is unable to live in a moment without Krishna consciousness. I cannot but think of Krishna 25 hours a day. I'm not talking about an Uttamadi career, a pure devotee as opposed to other conditions.
Okay. So the question is raised, I think, effectively, 22, where Krishna is carrying what you lack and preserving what you have, does this only apply to the most elevated devotees? Am I right?
Yes.
Well, it applies more to them, certainly, but it applies to all the devotees to some degree. But for the very elevated devotees who are completely in love with Krishna and who Krishna is completely in love with, then of course he does more. But for the neophytes, he does many things. Haven't you experienced some interventions by Krishna? I think we've all experienced. Some things have happened out of the blue, and we understand, the devotee understands, this is Krishna's mercy. Okay, I don't know if this is appropriate, but this is a real life experience. It was the GBC meetings 2003, and there was a vote who should become the chairman of the GBC body, and very few devotees were willing to be considered. They were refusing. I was foolish enough to be one of the ones who said, alright, you know, you can put my name in the ballot. So then we all had to go out and they took a vote. And when I went out, I thought, Krishna, if you want me to be the chairman of the GBC body, I'll do my best. But if you want me to be the chairman of the GBC body, I think you're crazy. This is a true story. So they voted that way, as many of you would know. And I thought, my God, Krishna, what are you doing? But anyway, we did our best. Hare Krishna. Okay, so back to Bhagavad Gita. So Krishna now has established this principle that with the non-devotees, it's their karma. They're due to get this, they get it. They're due to get that, they get it. Not a little more, not a little less. It works, you know, very precisely. But with the devotees, it's different, because Krishna is a friend. Krishna helps. Whether the devotee deserves it or not, Krishna has his own way, and his way is he wants to help his devotees. And the process of devotional service is so wonderful because it reflects Krishna's nature, that if you engage in devotional service, even if, you know, you get a bit mixed up sometimes, Krishna will intervene and help you, unless you really insist on turning your back on Krishna. You know, then after some time he may let you, but he'll really, really try before he comes to that point. So let's now have a look at verses 30 and 31. These are really very amazing verses. Even if one commits the most abominable action, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly. because he's properly situated in his determination. Telephone. Ah, 20 rand fine. Whoa. You know what they say, you can tell a person's character by the ringtone on their phone. Right, so let's look at this. And for that matter, well, let's start on this one, okay. So now we're talking about a devotee. Even if one commits the most abominable action, this one we're talking about is a devotee. Even if a devotee commits the most abominable action, but if he remains engaged in devotional service, then how do you identify him? How should you see this person? You know, what is this person? Is he out of it or what? No, he is to be considered saintly. In fact, the Sanskrit term is sadhu. Sadhu, very classic term for a very classic spiritual person. So if he's engaged, if he remains engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly because he's properly situated in his determination. His activities may not be properly situated, but his fundamental determination that I am going to continue in devotional service, that is properly situated. So when we see that devotee, then we should consider this is a devotee, not that this is a nonsense, you know, this is a fool, something like that. I'll tell you one little story which some of you will have definitely heard before, is that one time Prabhupada, there were two devotees with Prabhupada. Some devotees with Prabhupada. The secretary was reading the mail. Yeah, letters would come into Prabhupada every day. And the other devotees were sitting there. Prabhupada was was being massaged and relaxing. And so anyway, the secretary read this letter. And in the letter, the devotee said, Srila Prabhupada, you know, I'm having so much difficulty. I'm trying to practice devotional service, but then sometimes I just become too attracted and I smoke. And then, you know, I feel bad about it. But I can't stop. But then after a few days, after a little while, I pull myself together and I stop. And now I'm not smoking. I'm doing devotional service. Then after a little while, it starts coming back and coming back. And I just smoke again. And then I'm smoking for a little while. And then I stop. So this one devotee was sitting there, the one devotee who told us the story. He was sitting there listening and he was thinking, what sort of devotee is this? Smoking. And then he stops, and then he smokes again. I mean, is he really a devotee, or what is he? Like that. Maybe he's not really a devotee, he's just a, you know, acting as a devotee sometimes. Then at the end, Prabhupada, sitting there, you know, a very thoughtful Prabhupada said, what a great soul. He's struggling so much for Krishna. Despite these difficulties, still, he's trying. So it's like, you know, another perspective. On one side you could say, this is a nonsense. But Prabhupada didn't look on that side. And why? Because in terms of this verse, this devotee is firmly fixed in his basic determination Although, you know, the conscious mind and the senses are sometimes giving way to the material energy, but he remains fixed in his determination to continue serving Krishna. So we consider that person saintly. This does not apply if the devotee does some nonsense and doesn't remain fixed in devotional service and just goes off and becomes absorbed in material life and gives up Krishna consciousness altogether. Then they're not to be considered saintly, but they're simply fallen devotees. But in this case, they have to be seen as being saintly. So in this regard, we have a little time because prasadam is still coming. And you're all alert now in expectation of the prasadam. I want to read, it's a few paragraphs from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura, his commentary on this verse and the next verse are very, you know, like heartfelt. He is speaking as if Krishna is speaking. Another 20 minutes. Oh, that's my telephone. I lost that 20 rounds. So now here's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura commenting on this verse, speaking as if Krishna is speaking. My attachment to my devotee is my very nature. That attachment does not decrease even if the devotee commits wrong, for I make him come up to the highest standard. If someone with bad conduct, addicted to violence, thievery, or adultery, sudaracha, worships me and worships no one except me, and does not follow any other process like karma or jnana, and has no other desire than my desire, he is my devotee. He is a sadhu. Arjuna replies, but considering his bad conduct, how is he a devotee? Krishna replies, he is to be respected as a devotee because of his quality of being a devotee, that he's attached to Krishna. It is a command. Not thinking so is an offense. My order is the authority. Arjuna replies, so he should be considered a devotee in that portion where he worships you, but as a non-devotee in that portion where he commits adultery or whatever. Krishna, no. He should be considered as a devotee in all his paths. You should not see his bad qualities at all. He is completely convinced. You know, this means the devotee is fixed in that determination to serve Krishna, despite the mind and the senses, you know, sort of declaring war on him. He makes a splendid resolution. I will go to hell for my sinful actions, which is so hard to give up. But I will not give up dedicated worship of Krishna. So then the next verse, 31, he quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. So let me continue with the purport here. Arjuna complains, how can you accept the worship of such a sinful person? How can you eat the food and drink offered by a heart contaminated by lust and anger? Krishna replies, very quickly he becomes righteous. The present is used, and not the future, to express the fact that having committed sin, by remembering me, he becomes repentant, and very quickly becomes righteous. He thinks, "Oh, how unfortunate I am. There is no one as low as I, bringing bad name to the devotees." Repeatedly, he feels completely disgusted. Or, the use of the present tense can indicate that in the future, he will develop righteousness fully. But even right now, it exists in a subtle form. After taking medicine, though the destructive effects of fever or poison remain for some time, that is not considered seriously. Thus, with the entrance of bhakti in his mind, the sinful actions are not taken seriously. And the traces of sin, such as lust and anger, should be considered insignificant, like the biting of a toothless snake. Thus he attains complete cessation of lust and anger permanently. In nigacchati, one of the words there in the verse. Ni stands for nitaram, completely. This means that even during the stage of having the tendency to commit sin, he has a pure heart. Arjuna says, if he eventually becomes righteous, there would be no argument. However, if this devotee is sinful right up till his death, what is his position? So, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur then speaks, the Lord, affectionate to his devotees, then speaks loudly, with a little anger. O son of Kunti, my devotee is not destroyed. At the time of death, he does not fall. Arjuna argues. But arguers with harsh tongues will not respect this. Krishna then encourages the worried, lamenting Arjuna. O Arjuna, go to that squabbling assembly with a tumultuous sound of drums, throwing your hands in the air, and throwing your hands in the air. You should fearlessly declare this. Arjuna says, what? Krishna says, declare that my devotee, the devotee of the Supreme Lord, though committing sin, does not perish, but rather reaches success. Arguments defeated, pride deflated. Those people who are arguing the opposite, their arguments defeated and their pride deflated, they should undoubtedly respect you as a guru. Hare Krishna. What do you think of that? Pretty amazing.
It's a simple activity.
Even someone who's offensive, you know, but particularly sinful activity. Sudaracha. Yeah. So they have something really quite special. Devotional service is so powerful. You know, if normally he mentioned violence, thievery, adultery. Normally if you do things like this, you go to hell. But if you're a devotee and you remain fixed in devotional service, you're to be considered saintly. Right, so. Oh, excuse me, yes.
Practicing devotional service externally, but somehow he doesn't really
Anyway. Well, you know, he's a borderline case, but it's quite possible he can become corrected. But this is talking about someone who really remains fixed in his conviction, despite being overwhelmed by personal weakness like that. It's particularly applying to that type of person. But others who are sort of in between, you know, cheaters, and they're not fixed in devotional service, but taking advantage or something like that, then sort of proportionately it wouldn't apply. But still, if they remain in the association of devotees, they may also become purified. Yeah. So therefore we are not quick to reject devotees. We're not quick to reject devotees. Rather, we would like to give them another chance, unless it just becomes too much of a disturbance. So, then he says, 32 and 33. 32, people who papa yonaya means people like, well, it means people from with sinful birth, like Malechas, Yavanas, Chandalas, people like that. They can also take to Krishna consciousness and be delivered. What to speak of people like women, Vaishyas, Sudras? They can also take to the process even more so and be delivered. And then what to speak of people who are born in wonderful situations, very like saintly families, and where all facility is there, then where is there any doubt that they can go back to Godhead? Therefore, having come to this temporary miserable world, engage in loving service unto me. So then verse 34, last verse in the chapter, yeah, this is a famous verse. This is one verse which appears twice in Bhagavad Gita. It's also 1865, so it's a very important verse. These are like the essential, this is like the essence of the confidential knowledge, how to render ananya bhakti, how to render unalloyed devotional service. Engage your mind always in thinking of Krishna, become Krishna's devotee, offer obeisances to him and worship him, and if completely absorbed in him like that, surely you'll come to him. Baladev Vijayabhushan says, the mind should be fixed on Krishna uninterruptedly, like honey flows from a bottle. None of you are thinking of prasadam, are you? Well, prasadam is Krishna. Okay. Well, let me just close for the time being by, let us just have a look at one excerpt from the purport to this verse 34. This is now the last paragraph. The last paragraph of the purport of verse 34. There's a beautiful poem about Krishna in which it is clearly stated that any person who is engaged in the worship of demigods is most unintelligent and cannot achieve at any time the supreme award of Krishna. The devotee in the beginning may sometimes fall from the standard, but still he should be considered superior to other philosophers and yogis. One who always engages in Krishna consciousness should be understood to be a perfectly saintly person. His accidental, non-devotional activities will diminish, and he'll soon be situated without any doubt in complete perfection. The pure devotee has no actual chance to fall down, because the Supreme Godhead personally takes care of his pure devotees. Therefore, the intelligent person should take directly to the process of Krishna consciousness and happily live in this material world. He'll eventually receive the supreme award of Krishna. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki.
Yeah.